you haven't before, to be eligible for the drawing. You know, the question really is, I was raised in a church where we talked about faith, and there wasn't a lot of reason for faith. Reason and faith were opposite things. But when I got introduced to Dr. Ross and the whole world of apologetics, I realized there is reason for our faith. There's good biblical and scientific foundation for our faith. And it's been one of the most exciting things to happen in my life. It's brought me so much closer to the Lord. So one of the fun things about science is you get to test it, you get to question it, you get to try to parse it out. And so I hope some of the questions that we get this morning will be about that. It's good to ask questions. It's good to test. It's good because when you get a good answer for something, you own that answer. You don't just take someone else's word for it. We do this about two or three times a year. Skeptics Forum is sponsored by Paradox Class and the Los Angeles chapter of Reasons to Believe. I'll tell you about Paradox Class. It is one of the Sunday school classes here at Sierra Madre Congregational Church. We meet every Sunday. Dr. Ross is the speaker. We meet at this time, 11:15, over in room 154. So if you're interested and you want more, come next Sunday. It's also sponsored by the Los Angeles chapter of Reasons to Believe. RTB has chapters all over the country. The LA chapter is here, and we are some of the people who are involved in Paradox Class and sponsoring this event. Also, if you know of people that wanted to come, or you want to come again, but they wanted to come today and they couldn't because they were going to church somewhere else, or they wanted to sleep in, or whatever, there's another one tomorrow night. And the one in tomorrow night is at 7 o'clock in room 154, right over there, again, where the Paradox Class meets. I want to thank whoever brought all the treats. Who brought the treats this morning? Raise your hand. Let's give them a hand. Thank you for bringing goodies. Very much appreciate it. There's a couple of rules with the microphone. You may ask as many questions as you like. But if there is a line, please go to the end of the line before you ask your second question. If you're shy to go to the mic and you have a burning question, please write your question down and you can pass it to me or this gentleman right here with the gimpy leg right in front. Raise your hand, Mark. Everybody say hi, Mark.
Hi, Mark.
Mark will be happy to take your question and pass it to me, and we will... I'll read it to Dr. Ross. There's a book table over there with all of Dr. Ross's latest stuff with the lovely Diana and Colleen. Say hello. Great. Okay. Like I said, we're going to go till about 1 o'clock. We have another one tomorrow night. Fill out the cards, and I want to introduce Dr. Hugh Ross. Hugh Ross is president and founder of Reasons to Believe. He's the author of more books than I have a number for. Last time it was 14. He has a BA in physics from the University of British Columbia. He has a PhD in astronomy from the University of Toronto, and he's a really smart guy. And he will take on any question you have regarding theology, science, philosophy, anything relating to the Christian faith. So let's say a word of prayer, and we will get started. Lord God, you tell us to test everything. You allow us the luxury of being able to question. I'm so grateful for this time here. We are so grateful for this time to address our questions to Dr. Ross. We thank you for this opportunity and ask that everything that happens this morning is honoring of you. In Jesus' name, amen. Everybody, welcome Dr. Hugh Ross.
Well, as advertised, this is a time for you to ask any question that you care to ask on science faith issues. Literally anything goes. Just one question per person per turn, please. And no fair giving me a four-part question. Got a four-part question, going to ask you to take four separate turns. Unless nobody else is behind you in the line, then you can keep going. but I still appreciate if you give me the questions one at a time. Now, typically what I do is I start things off by telling you about a latest discovery, and I got a whole folder here of discoveries made this past week. But I thought I'd begin by asking you a question. What is the size of the largest telescope ever built? And whoever gets the right answer, we're going to have these ladies over here at the back give you a free copy of this DVD where I do a skeptics forum in front of 700 atheists at Caltech. So, ladies, you can get that one. That's only if you get the right answer, though. All right. Over here. 30 meters. That indeed is the world's largest optical telescope. But there actually is a larger telescope than 30 meters across.
Does this include me? Because I just read this last night.
You did?
Yeah.
If you get it right, we'll make an exception.
No, go ahead.
Anyway, that's called the extremely large telescope. There's actually a telescope that's extremely larger. Yes. Pardon me? 36 meters? No, we're talking something bigger than 36 meters. Yes. Okay, the array of several telescopes called the Very Long Baseline Interferometer. That's a very big telescope that stretches all the way from Hawaii to the Virgin Islands. So almost 6,000 miles in diameter. But it's not the largest telescope. I guess I'm not going to be able to give away this DVD. Not too surprising because its first result was published just last week. So a first light. That's what they call a first discovery made with a brand new telescope. They call it first light. And they use this telescope to measure plasma clouds between us and pulsars in our Milky Way galaxy. But the size of this telescope is 136,400 miles. See, how do you get a telescope that big? Well, they actually put a telescope on a rocket and sent it out 136,000 miles from Earth, and they were able to link its observations with the Arecibo telescope. Now, the Arecibo telescope is 1,000 feet across. If you go to Puerto Rico, there's a parabolic valley, a natural parabolic valley, that they actually built a telescope inside. It's not steerable, I mean, in the sense that they can't move the telescope around, but they move the feet around. And by moving the feet around, they're able to grab about 35-degree wide swath of the sky. And that tells me that you're probably not watching 007 movies, because one of the more recent 007 movies featured James Bond having a battle on the movable feet on this 1,000-foot telescope, where it was a 600-foot drop to the bottom. So that's the largest ground-based radio telescope, 1,000 feet in diameter, the largest instrument where you're not linking together telescopes, but they link together the Arecibo telescope, what is called the Westerbork Array, which is 8 telescopes linked together in the Netherlands with this telescope that they put into outer space. How big was that outer space telescope? It was 30 meters across. So as large as the extremely large telescope in Chile. And so those three instruments were linked together to give a telescope with the equivalent power of a telescope 136,400 miles in diameter. And so this is the first discovery that was announced, the plasma study. But of course they're going to be using this instrument to do some really amazing things. It's the highest resolution telescope ever constructed by human beings. And so we can look forward to some really stunning discoveries in the next couple of years from this instrument. Okay, I still don't see anybody behind the microphone, so I'll talk to you about another discovery also published just this week. How many of you have ever heard of what's called the habitable zone? Yes, a lot of you. That's where astronomers look at these planets outside of our solar system and try to determine whether or not life is possible on them. But when they talk about the habitable zone, they're talking about what's called the liquid water habitable zone or the temperature habitable zone. How far away the planet must be from its star its host star so that you have the possibility of liquid water existing on its surface. Now, as an astronomer, I can tell you I'm not too impressed. Liquid water is the second or third most abundant molecule in the universe. We've got moons of Jupiter that are 65% water. So water is literally everywhere in the universe. And you'll get liquid water if you've got a temperature between 0 and 100 degrees centigrade. That's 32 and 212 degrees for you Fahrenheit people. And so it's not too surprising that we're finding some planets in that zone. But that's only one of many habitable zones. And so, for example, let me kind of give you the list. And what's been going on with this liquid water habitable zone is that they said back in 1995 that to be in that temperature zone, the planet had to be within 95 to 137% of the Earth's distance from the Sun. That's assuming, of course, that the planet is orbiting a Sun-like star. It's orbiting a star a little more massive, you want to be farther away. A little less massive, you want to be closer. But as you can see, that's a fairly narrow range. But then some astronomers said, we're not getting too many planets in the habitable zone. Let's see if we can make it bigger. And so they said, well, what if the planet were to be as dark as the moon? And to give you some idea, our Earth reflects 30 to 35% of the solar radiation back to outer space, whereas the moon only reflects 7%. So if you've got a moon that's really, really dark, or a planet that's really, really dark like the moon, you could actually push that out to 167%. So they say, hey, now we've got a much bigger habitable zone. Of course, it raises a question, can you really have life on a planet that surface is as dark as the moon? Only way you're going to get it dark as the moon is if there's no water and no clouds, and that kind of defeats the purpose. And then just last year, a group said we were wrong on the 95%. It's really 99%, which means our Earth is barely outside the habitable zone. If we were any closer to the Sun, we would not be in the habitable zone. And by the way, how do they calculate this? If you're too close, all the water vapor evaporates and the planet goes completely dry. And if you're too far away, all the water goes into snow and ice. And so, but they're saying maybe 99 to 167%. But just the past couple of weeks, some papers have been published where they said we can make a 39 to 225%. How did 39%? That's about as close as Mercury is to the Sun. And we know it's 600 degrees Fahrenheit on the surface of Mercury, 800 degrees Fahrenheit on the surface of Venus. How can you get a planet that close? They said, here's how we do it. Extremely thin atmosphere. The rotation axis is 0 degrees, so you don't get any seasons. Have 1%, less than 1% humidity. And we're talking about having tiny pools of water at the north and south poles. But if you don't have seasons, you've got problems. And if you've got an atmosphere that thin, then you can't have photosynthetic life. And if it's that dry, life isn't going to survive for very long. So then you say, well, how can you get out to 225%? That's if you've got a water world where the water is being heated by geothermal hotspots. So you've got a lot of internal volcanic activity, way more than what the Earth has, and that's the problem. Because we don't know of any body that can have more geothermal activity than the Earth. And you need a whole lot more to get it out to 225%. Bottom line is, it's 95 to 137%. But the 39 to 225 is where they get the answer. There are 40 billion habitable planets in our Milky Way galaxy. And if there's that many, when we mess up our planet Earth, we can all go in spaceships and go to another one. Hey, we're talking about a planet that could conceivably sustain the most primitive bacterium for 3 months. Do you really want to go there? Okay, but here's the real dilemma. We're not only looking at a water habitable zone, you're looking at an ultraviolet habitable zone. Because if you don't have ultraviolet radiation coming into the surface, there's certain enzymes critical for life that'll never be able to be assembled. Ultraviolet is critical for making that happen. And by the way, ultraviolet light is important for you. If you don't have ultraviolet light, you're not going to be able to make vitamin D. If you don't make vitamin D, you're going to die. And even if you get a little bit of vitamin D, you're going to get cancer. And so you do want to make sure you get enough ultraviolet light exposure. But if you get too much ultraviolet light exposure, by the way, did you know that ultraviolet light is important to avoid depression? If you don't get enough ultraviolet light exposed on your skin, it will not stimulate the pineal gland. And if the pineal gland isn't stimulated, you're going to be depressed all the time. You're not going to want to be alive. So what's the point of having a habitable planet if you don't want to be alive? So, and the other thing, of course, is ultraviolet light helps with certain skin rashes like psoriasis and eczema. But too much ultraviolet light will give you skin cancer and you'll die. So it's got to be just right. And what they discovered is the ultraviolet, by the way, it's not just human beings. Things like photosynthetic light also require a highly fine-tuned amount of ultraviolet light. Even the most primitive, non-photosynthetic prokaryote bacterium needs a measured amount of ultraviolet light. Not too much, not too little. Now, mind you, the zone's a little bit bigger for the simplest bacteria, but that zone is far, far narrower than the ultraviolet habitable zone. Moreover, they typically don't overlap. Where you got the water habitable zone, you don't have the ultraviolet habitable zone. And what's unique about our solar system, they overlap for planet Earth. And you want photosynthetic light, and you say, why do you need that? Well, photosynthetic light delivers an energetic payoff that measures from hundreds to millions of times greater than non-photosynthetic light. So if you want to have any activity out of your life, you're going to have photosynthesis operating. And there we're finding that the stellar properties are extremely fine-tuned. And once again, it's typical that the photosynthetic zone does not overlap the ultraviolet habitable zone or liquid water habitable zone. Then you've got the ozone habitable zone, and you need ozone. Without ozone, you're going to get ultraviolet light coming in from the star at a level that's going to kill all life. But if you don't have any, if you have too little or too much ozone, then you're going to get respiratory failure. And it's also going to cause plant life to die and even the bacteria to die. So you need some ozone, but you don't want so much ozone that you're going to get biochemical smog and you're going to get respiratory failure. And what was just published this week is that the rotation rate of the planet determines what kind of clouds you have. And if you got the wrong clouds, it's going to mess up the ozone habitable zone, the photosynthetic habitable zone, the ultraviolet light habitable zone, and liquid water habitable zone. Here's two more. You need a tidal habitable zone. We need tides. Tides are crucial to slow the rotation rate of the planet down to that which is appropriate for more advanced life forms. But too much tidal interaction, you get tidal locking, which means the rotation rate of the planet now becomes months and years, which is going to make it very hot in the daytime and very cold at night. It's also crucial for recycling nutrients. And then you've got the astrosphere habitable zone. This one was just discovered a few months ago. Say, what is that? That refers to, quote, the atmosphere around a star. Really refers to the wind that's blown off from the star. You may have heard of the solar wind. The solar wind is good for you. What the solar wind does is it pushes back the deadly cosmic rays. And if we didn't have a strong solar wind, we would be dying quite quickly from cosmic radiation. But if you got too strong a solar wind, the solar wind will kill you. And for example, when we send astronauts to the moon, we have to send those astronauts to the moon in a tiny time window where the solar wind counterbalances the cosmic rays at a level that those astronauts don't suffer too much radiation damage. By the way, they do come back with damage. But if you pick a window of time about 3 or 4 days wide, you can minimize the solar wind damage and the cosmic ray damage by picking up. So that's what they do when they're trying to send people to the moon. They measure the solar wind, and the solar wind is just right, then they send them to the moon and get them back in a hurry. But that's the wonderful thing about the Earth. We're living at a time, a narrow time window, when the solar wind is just right to hold back that cosmic radiation without the solar wind doing us too much damage. Now, what's the probability of getting all seven habitable zones matching together where they actually all overlap? That 40 billion shrinks down to one. Earth is the only planet that we know of, and our star is the only star that we know of that would allow all these seven zones to be met. And incidentally, we're discovering a new zone about once a year, so I think more are coming. So, but that's the latest. And gee, there's still nobody behind the microphone.
We've got somebody.
All right.
I get to monitor the microphone, so I get to ask the first question. A lot of skeptics and atheists keep pointing to quantum mechanics and quantum uncertainty to try and explain the origin of this universe. And I find ask me if that's correct. I find it totally absurd because they're using things within this universe to try and describe the origin of this universe. That's like trying to use the laws of physics of this universe to describe how this universe came into existence when we have, it seems to me, no evidence that quantum mechanics or quantum physics worked before the Big Bang, before the singularity. Is my assumption correct that it's totally absurd and totally wild speculation of how in the world you could try and use quantum mechanics and quantum uncertainty to explain the origin of this universe because those only exist in this universe that we know of?
Well, the short answer to that is that the space-time theorems establish that matter, energy, space and time, all the space-time dimensions, did not exist until the universe came into existence. And that would include all the math and physics. So you don't even have quantum mechanics until the universe comes into existence. So how can you create the universe with quantum mechanics if quantum mechanics doesn't exist yet? Now, there are atheists who are saying, well, maybe there's some kind of supra quantum mechanics that exists before the universe exists. Of course, that's pure speculation. And then they will appeal to things like virtual particle production to explain how our universe came into existence, basically saying you really can get something from nothing. Of course, you always have to ask the atheist physicists, what do you mean by nothing? Okay, and so I've actually written a review on these quantum creation models on our website. Basically, it was a response to Lawrence Krauss's book, Universe from Nothing. So you'll see that on our reasons.org website. It's free. You don't have to pay for it. That's up there. You can read it at your leisure. But what I point out is that he uses seven different definitions of nothing, all of which are something. And then I added two more definitions to his list. So, in fact, I remember many years ago, I did the church service here where I gave a lecture on everything you want to know about nothing and talked about all these different definitions of nothing. But probably the favorite one of the atheist physics community is to refer to these virtual particles. And what's happening is that you're getting quantum space-time fluctuations. So quantum mechanical fluctuations in the space-time surface on which everything in the universe resides. So all the matter in the universe resides on the space-time surface. But quantum mechanics tells us that the surface jiggles a little bit. And that quantum jiggling of the surface does produce particles. But we call them virtual particles because they return to the space-time surface in a window of time that's briefer than the time we need to detect them. On the other hand, we know that this is actually going on because we see byproducts of virtual particle production. So we know this phenomenon is taking place, but we've not been able to capture a virtual particle. The laws of quantum mechanics tell us they have to return to the quantum space-time foam before we can detect them. Now, how short a time we're talking about? Much, much briefer than a trillionth of a second is how long these virtual particles last. And the principles of quantum mechanics tell us that the time in which the particle that you make from the quantum space-time foam in terms of its return time back is proportional to the mass. Now, these virtual particles that we're making weigh less than an electron. So if we're talking something as massive as the universe, it returns to the quantum space-time foam in under 10 to the minus 122 seconds. So that's 121 zeros between the decimal point and the one. And I think everybody realizes that the universe is older than 10 to the minus 122 seconds. So we didn't get there by that means. But you can actually rule out all quantum speculations simply by making note that the probability of getting a quantum outcome is proportional to the passage of time. And the space-time theorems tell us that time did not exist until the universe was created. And so the creation of the universe is the universe coming into existence in a zero-time interval. And if the time interval is zero, the quantum probability is zero. So our universe didn't get here by quantum mechanics. It got here through the agency of an entity that exists beyond quantum mechanics, gravity, space, time, matter, and energy. But please don't be surprised that you can get mass from space. Special relativity tells us that you can convert matter into energy and energy into matter. E equals mc squared. It's reversible. Well, likewise, general relativity tells us you can get matter out of space and time. You can get energy out of space and time. But they also tell us it can't be reversed. In other words, you can't use matter and energy to gain space and time. As space unfurls from the cosmic creation event, it produces energy and matter, but it's not reversible. Next question.
Daniel the prophet in Daniel chapter 12, verse 11 and 12 writes, "From the time that a regular sacrifice is abolished and the abomination of desolation is set up, there will be 1,290 days. How blessed is he who keeps waiting and attains to the 1,335 days. Well, my question is, do these numbers account for the outline of the 7 weeks of Daniel, which Daniel writes in chapter 9, verses 24 through 27? If so, then can you break down these two set of numbers that Daniel explains?
Yes. What you'll see in Daniel 2 and 4 is it defines what a week is. It says a week is 7 years. And so what you see in Daniel 9 is that 69 weeks will pass between the issuing of a decree by the Persian Empire to rebuild Jerusalem and its temple system of worship and the coming of the Messiah. Now, that's a little bit tricky because those are actually two different dates. Because the Persian king issued a decree to start rebuilding the city of Jerusalem and later issued another decree to rebuild the temple. So there's quite a few years between them. But it does give you a rough idea of when the Messiah will come. And that explains the visit of the Magi. The Magi, by the way, Daniel was called the greatest of the Magi. The word Magi means Eastern wise men. And so Daniel was the greatest of the Magi, and he wrote the book of Daniel. And so what we see in the account of the Christmas star is that the Magi apparently were only familiar with one book of the Bible, Daniel. But chapter 9 of Daniel gives you a rough date for when the Messiah will come. And so they counted up those 483 years. That's what 69 times 7 is. Figured out this must be the time of the coming of the Messiah. And they went to Jerusalem. But notice what you see in the gospel accounts. They had no idea of the location. They went to Jerusalem and inquired of the scribes and Pharisees there, where will he be born? And they said, well, you know, Micah says it's going to be in Bethlehem. So they went off to Bethlehem. But Daniel gave him the time. The prophet Micah gave him the location. But that what you also see in Daniel 9, there will be a 70th week. So it's referring to a future period of 7 years. And what we're hearing from the questioner is that this 7 year period is broken down into 1,260 days and 1,290 days. And it talks about this period, 1,335 or 45 days, So the question is, what's going on with all this division of this last week of years? And that 70th week is referring to a period of time that would immediately precede the return of the Messiah. So what Daniel 9 is talking about how the Messiah will come twice. He will come after 483 years from the issuing of the decree to rebuild Jerusalem, and he's going to come 7 years after the end of the human age here on earth. By the way, I was having a conversation with two Jewish scholars just a few days ago at our Reasons to Believe office, and they said, you know, we reject Jesus as a Messiah because he only fulfilled one third of the Old Testament prophecies concerning his coming. I said, well, that's still over 100 prophecies he fulfilled. Isn't that pretty impressive? I said, well, we're waiting for the other 200. I said, well, look at the book of Daniel. Daniel says he comes twice. So he fulfills some in the first coming and the rest in the second coming. They said, well, we think he's going to fulfill them all in one coming. And so what do you do with the fact that the prophecies concerning the first coming say he will suffer and the second coming he will conquer? How can you suffer and conquer? That just doesn't make sense that would all happen in one event. They said, well, the idea of the Messiah coming twice is nonsense. I said, well, do you celebrate the Passover? And they said, every year. I said, do you have an empty chair at the Passover? And they said, yes, we do. I said, who's that empty chair for? And they said, Elijah. Oh, so you believe in the second coming of Elijah? They do. But they deny the second coming of the Messiah. Well, you can see where I was going with that. If Elijah, a mere human, can come twice, why can't the one that created the universe come twice? So anyway, that kind of, they changed the subject at that point. But to go back to your question here, sorry, I got off on a side trail. I sometimes do that. What you'll see in the book of Revelation, it also addresses this final 7-year period. But instead of giving you days, it gives you months. And so it talks about this 7-year period being divided up into 42 months and 42 months. And this is what's caused a lot of speculation. I mean, if you watch Christian television, you'll hear a lot of speakers talking about these 42 months, or these 1,260 days, or these 1,290 days, and they begin to make predictions based on the Bible, giving you exact dates as to when these different events will happen during that 7-year period. Now, some will even go so far and tell you when the 7-year period will begin. But most of them will say, no, we don't know when it will begin, but once it begins, this is exactly what the calendar will look like. Here's what they're overlooking. When Daniel said 1,290 days, he meant plus or minus 10. And when you have in the book of John 42 months, he means plus or minus 1. The Bible uses rounded numbers. So, for example, when it talks about 2 million enemy soldiers being killed, it doesn't mean exactly 2 million. It might have been 1,998,807. You round it off, that's 2 million. And we need to realize the Bible does this consistently. You know, many skeptics think that there's a contradiction because you've got Stephen saying that the Jews will be wandering in Egypt for 400 years, and Paul says 440 years. Well, both of them are rounding off. One's rounding off to one place of the decimal, one's rounding off to two places of the decimal. Wouldn't surprise me, the real answer is 438. I mean, there's no contradiction. But my whole point here is don't read too much into those numbers. They're accurate to three places of the decimal, not to four places of the decimal. And this is consistent with what Jesus told us. No man would know the hour or the day. You might know the month, you might know the week, but you're not going to know the hour or the day. And you're not going to know the month or the week until the event is almost on top of you. I'll give you an Old Testament example of that. God told Noah, go inside the ark, it's going to rain. He went inside the ark. How long did he have to wait before the rain came down? Yeah, he had to wait quite a few days before the rain started coming down. So here's Noah and his family inside the ark, listening to all the mockers outside saying, it's dry, it's not raining, but no man knows the hour of the day.
Hugh, we've got a question that was handed to me. We'll do this first, Ted.
Okay.
What is your opinion about global warming? Is it all propaganda?
Well, some of it is propaganda. There is no doubt that the planet's getting warmer, and by the way, that's not unusual. If you look at the ice cores in Antarctica, we see that our planet's been going through cycles of warming and cooling in response to the change in Earth's orbit. As Earth orbits about the sun, the tilt of the orbit varies a little bit, and that tilt will affect the climate. And as it orbits about the sun, the shape of the orbit changes. I mean, all planets have an elliptical orbit, but as the sun as the Earth orbits about the sun, the ellipticity of its orbit gets bigger and then smaller by tiny amounts. That turns out to have a rather significant effect on the ice age cycle. Right now, the ice age cycle is primarily driven by the variation in the eccentricity of Earth's orbit. And right now, the period of that variation is 100,000 years. So for the last 4 million years, we've had 40 ice ages where you get about 90,000 years of ice, followed by 10,000 years, what we call a warm interglacial. And we're in a warm interglacial right now. But when you're in a warm interglacial, the temperature rapidly goes up to a peak, and when it hits a peak, it rapidly drops down, and you get an ice age. The only exception to that ice age cycle is the one we're in now, where it went rapidly up, and then 3 degrees below the maximum temperature we see in all ice ages, it leveled off. It's been level for the last 9,000 years. And that's called the long, warm spring. And no climatologist knows why we've had this exceptional stable period. We do know that the warm spring is the best temperature for global high technology civilization. So I'm actually giving credit to our Creator that for the last 9,000 years, He has stabilized our climate at the optimum, but there's a limit to how long He can sustain that. And yes, the temperature is getting warmer. If you don't believe me, start taking vacations in the Canadian mountains. I've been doing that for, 50 years now, and every year the glaciers get smaller and smaller. And I've lived long enough to witness the polar ice cap shrinking by a factor of 2. You know, when I was a child, I was told that no one will ever be able to take a freighter through the Northwest Passage. You know, being a Canadian, we were told about all these efforts by the British and the French and the Dutch trying to find a way to get a boat through the Northwest Passage. Too much ice. It's wide open now. You can take a 200,000-ton tanker through the Northwest Passage because of how much ice has melted. So global warming is real. What we don't know, however, is the degree to which human activity has contributed to that warming. We actually have a climatologist who's going to be starting as a visiting scholar at Reasons to Believe Monday. And he got his PhD in the climate of planet Earth over the last 50,000 years. He's our global warming expert, and he's actually going to be writing a book on global warming. So, hey, if you want to talk to Kevin Birdwell, come by our office, and I'm actually going to try to get him to come to the Paradoxes class to talk to all of you about global warming. But if he were here, what Kevin would tell you, we know that human activity is responsible for at least 20% of the global warming we're observing, but no more than 80%. So it's somewhere between 20 and 80%, which explains the politics and the propaganda. You've got one group who insists it's 80%, another group that insists it's 20%, and if it's 20, you're going to be advocating different political solutions than if it's 80, and it's going to be radically different. And that explains the political fight over global warming. It's because our science is not yet precise enough to give our politicians the answer they want. Now, you'll find over there a book that I wrote called Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job. And what you see in the Book of Job is a creation care manual in Job 37, 38, and 39. And what you see in the Book of Job is that God has made us humans responsible to manage this planet for the benefit of all life. But what you see in Job 37, the first part of Job 38, the thing we're to pay special attention to is precipitation. And if we disturb the precipitation, we're to correct it. And what I point out in my book, if you do that, it'll be the best thing you can do to resolve global warming. Because we humans have had a devastating effect at making deserts much bigger. We've made the Sahara Desert 10 times bigger. Where now the Sahara Desert is bigger than Australia. It used to be a tenth the size of Australia. And we've done that just in 2,000 years. The Gobi Desert is 4 times bigger. It's now so big it's inside the suburbs of Beijing. It's got the Chinese government's attention for obvious reasons. It's right in their capital city now. Job tells us how to reverse that. And if we reverse that, we can grow more food, we'll have more money, and it's one of the best things we can do to resolve global warming. And if you read the book, you'll see two other solutions that I propose based on the book of Job on how to resolve global warming. But all three solutions are solutions that will cool the climate of the planet substantially and at the same time substantially boost the economy of the world. And that's the political football. One side is saying we have to make draconian sacrifices in our economy in order to resolve global warming. Another side is saying if we have to do that, we're not in favor. We do not want to make these draconian sacrifices, or they point out the obvious, how can you enforce them? Telling people to live on less money and less wealth is not an easy sell. And even if you sell all the Americans on it, how are you going to sell all the Chinese and Indians on sacrificing what little wealth they have in order to deal with global warming? But what if you offer solutions that boost the economy, put more money in people's pockets, and at the same time cool the planet? Everybody votes for it. That's how to get the propaganda out. Anyway, we want to read more. It's in the book.
Let me say one thing, Ted, before you ask your question. I keep putting you off. Fill out your cards. Another couple of questions, and we're going to take a break. And we'll do the drawing. Ted, go ahead.
Hello, Dr. Ross.
Hello.
I've heard some strange things about the Vatican Observatory Research Group, which is a group of Jesuit scientists that work out of Mount Graham and also out of the Vatican with their instrumentation there. And in particular, a Dr. Guy Consolmongo and Father Jose Fuentes. And these gentlemen, scientists, seem to think that there's a plenitude of life in the universe. And in fact, there are alien creatures out there and have strange thoughts on it. And I'm interested to know what you've heard, and I'm perplexed by it. I don't know what to believe about it, so I want to get your take on it and what you've heard about it.
Well, you can go on our reasons.org website, and that's where we interview Guy Consolmongo. So he's the chief Vatican astronomer, and I found out that Guy is a fan of Reasons to Believe. He really likes our fine-tuning arguments. However, he's also a Roman Catholic priest, as well as being one of the top astronomers in the world. And it's been Roman Catholic theology for a long time that there's life elsewhere in our galaxy and the rest of the universe. So that's not a new Roman Catholic position. And as Guy pointed out in the interview, it's not a position that Catholics are required to hold. But their whole point is, when you look at planet Earth, it seems like God creates in superabundance. I mean, everywhere you look, there's life on planet Earth, and every imaginable form you can expect is there. So it's like God is creating life in maximal abundance and maximum diversity here on planet Earth, and they simply extend that principle to the rest of the universe. Now, a Guy Consolmongo is very clear to point out, and you'll hear this in the interview we did with him, is that while he believes there's life on many other planets, he believes that that life cannot get there by natural means or by Darwinian evolution. It's God's supernatural hand that's responsible for creating that life in all these planets. So it's basically the theological position that God enjoys creating so much, he's not going to constrain himself to one planet. On the other hand, a guy would tell you that we've yet to find a star or a planet that would be a candidate. So it looks like God is not being too expressive of his creative power on other planets, because everywhere we look, we're seeing stars and planets that are non-candidates for life. Now, we also asked him the question, okay, you seem to also believe that there could be advanced life on other planets. So, well, sure, if God enjoys creating that much, he's not going to just create bacteria or just grass or moss. He's going to be creating animals. But he did agree with us that based on chapter 10 and 9 of the book of Hebrews, Earth is the only planet in the entire universe where you've got intelligent spiritual beings that are in need of redemption. Why? Because in those two chapters of Hebrews, it says the creator of the universe came to one planet, died one time, one place for all. So it's not Jesus Christ visiting millions of planets and being crucified and resurrected on millions of planets. He did it only here. So their position is, we think God may have made dolphins on another planet, you know, a highly advanced life form, maybe parrots, and cockatoos and crows, but this is the only planet where you got life like us. So, far as I know, Guy is still holding to that position. But I also know it's been a long time popular view of the Roman Catholic Church that there's life everywhere. By the way, there's an old article that I sponsored in Facts and Faith magazine. That's the first magazine that Reasons to Believe published. And yeah, it's all archived, where I had three astronomers defend three views. One, that God would create life everywhere. One, that God would create more primitive life in other places, and where Earth is the only place where you're going to find life of any form. And basically looking at three different theological perspectives. The Roman Catholic position, where God enjoys creating so much, he's not going to restrain himself to one planet. One where it says, you know, well, God does enjoy creating, but it really looks like there can't be too many places based on our observations. Then I purposely defended the view, this is the only place. And I based that on the theological position that when you read the gospel accounts, we see the creator of the universe is parsimonious with his miracles. He performs as few miracles as is necessary to achieve his purpose. And I make the point that this tremendous variety of life we see here on planet Earth, every bit of it is necessary in order to have humans that can launch and sustain global high technology civilization. Just like no star is wasted, no life form on planet Earth is wasted either in the context of human beings. And I still hold that position, that this will be the only place, with one important caveat. I've been on record since 1988, we will find the remains of life in every solar system body. Why? Because Earth is so prolific with life, it's exported the remains of life all over our solar system. Every time a big meteor hits the Earth, it causes Earth's soil to be exported. And I actually argue the best place to find that exported Earth life is the surface of the moon. You're literally looking at 20,000 kilograms of Earth's soil and every 100 square kilometers of the moon. And every ton of Earth's soil has 10 to the 17 microbes in it. So it shouldn't be that difficult to go to the moon and find the remains of Earth's life.
Let's take one more question and we'll fill out the cards while Christine's asking her question. If you could pass the cards, say, towards this center aisle here, and I'll walk down and pick them up.
Okay, so my question is, I've noticed that a lot of my friends my age who are Christians believe that the Bible no longer teaches that homosexuality is a sin and that the Bible supports same-sex marriage. I was wondering if you've noticed this trend as well, and if so, what your responses or comments would be to that issue.
I've definitely noticed that trend, especially in my native country of Canada. In fact, I can tell you, because of Canadian laws, when I'm in a Canadian church, I'm forbidden from saying anything negative about homosexual or lesbian lifestyles. Now, I am permitted, however, to talk about sexual immorality as a sin. So I avoid the topic homosexual and lesbian, but I go after sexual immorality. And I'm also permitted in Canada to give examples of sexual immorality. And so pointing out that, yes, you may favor the company of, say, if you're a man of men, but the Bible would still command you to refrain from sexual immorality with those men, or with women for that matter. And that the Bible does define sex as being moral only if it's within the context of a man and a woman that are bonded to one another for life. And therefore, I would also point out that sexual immorality would include the runaway divorce rate that we're experiencing both in the church and outside the church. And so you notice that the Bible has some strong words to say about men and women that leave their marriage partner. That's permissible, but only under extreme conditions. So I believe we're going to see the same movement here within the U.S., because I think we're only about 10 years behind what I see in Canada. I hope that doesn't happen, but it could happen. And now, what does the Bible say about homosexuality? Well, it categorically tells us that homosexual behavior is a sin. Now, what it means by homosexual behavior is a man lying with another man. Now, I say that because there's this trend within the United States and Canada to define homosexual behavior as broad enough to include a man enjoying the company of another man where they touch one another. But the Bible actually defines homosexual sin as a man lying with another man. So I think this is a good time for a joke, because it says in the Leviticus, if a man lies with a man, they should be stoned. And isn't it interesting that we've got states that actually legalize marijuana smoking and homosexuality at the same time? So in that sense, we could say Leviticus has been fulfilled. But anyway, that's just a joke. But it's not just the book of Leviticus. And this is the whole point. Those promoting the gay lifestyle said it's only in Leviticus. Well, you actually see it in Genesis, where we have every man, young and old, coming to Lot's door to commit homosexual rape against his visitors. And notice the visitors weren't even human. They were angelic beings. They were there to commit homosexual rape against what they thought were humans. And notice God rained down fire and brimstone on those individuals and wiped them all out. And notice too what you see in Romans chapter 1 where Paul makes the point that homosexuality indeed is a sin. You also see it in 1 Corinthians where some says some of you were into the homosexual lifestyle, and you, and to your credit, you've come out. Now, I think that's important because the Bible makes the point that, you know, when you look at Romans 1, it kind of brands the homosexual, and again, it's referring to a man who has sex with another man, brands him as one that's on a pathway towards rebellion against God, where it ends in reprobation. But notice that Paul says in 1 Corinthians 5 and 6, you can come out of that. And therefore, I'm a strong proponent of reaching out to people in the gay and lesbian community to deliver them from their lifestyle. And the way you do that, again, is be careful with your language. Is that when you look at all the sexual sins you see in the Bible, bestiality, homosexuality, a woman lying with a man, lesbian behavior, you know, where people go through serial marriages, where they divorce one person and marry another person. And in each case, what you're seeing there is a symptom of failed intimacy. How do you reach out to people with a gay lifestyle? You reach out to them by asking them and empathizing with their struggles to gain intimacy, because that's what's really behind all forms of sexual immorality. People trying to gain intimacy, chase after intimacy, but they're not willing to pay the price that the Bible tells us. Now, this is important for the gospel. For example, I shared an office at Caltech with an atheist astronomer from Australia. And he came to a point where he realized atheism isn't the way to go. And so he started pursuing all these other religions, Buddhism, Hinduism, Hare Krishna. And he says, I'm looking for salvation on the cheap. But there came a time when he said, Buddhism doesn't deliver. Hinduism doesn't deliver. Transcendental meditation doesn't deliver. Hare Krishna doesn't deliver. Yes, they promise salvation, and it's a cheap price, but it doesn't deliver. Only Christianity offers redemption that really does deliver. He says, the price was high, but he says, now I want to pay that price. And he gave his life to Christ. Well, likewise, people who are into sexual immorality, they're trying to get intimacy on the cheap. And as they try, they realize it doesn't satisfy. There's that old song by the Rolling Stones, I've Got No Satisfaction. And that's kind of, sometimes I share that with people in the gay and lesbian lifestyle, saying, how satisfied are you with your relationship? Well, your typical homosexual man has over 100 sexual partners a year. That's a clue that they're not getting satisfaction. But they just keep trying. They just say, well, I have more partners, I have more sex, that will do it. But the more they pursue it, the less satisfied they are. You're not going to be satisfied until you have a relationship with Jesus Christ. You're not going to be able to relate successfully to another human being unless you're bonded to the one that created you. That's what's going to make it possible to have a successful relationship with a woman. And it's going to have to be one man, one woman, where you got a lifetime commitment. And what really messes up sex is when people have sex before marriage. And a lot of our culture, including the church, doesn't recognize that sex outside of marriage is a problem. And what I tell young people is, if you engage in premarital sex, it's going to diminish the satisfaction you can have with sex in a marriage. And so, well, I'm committed to this person, I'm going to marry her. Wait. If you wait until that bond is secure, you're going to have the best sex life you can ever imagine. It'll get better and better. But if you engage in premarital sex, there will be consequences, and you will not get the satisfaction or the intimacy that God wants. And by the way, I've changed the way I'm doing marriages. I'm not just an astronomer, I'm also a pastor. I get to do a few marriages. And now when I deal with a couple that's getting married, I take them to Genesis 2. It says, here's the first marriage. And here's Adam being introduced to this woman that God created for him. What does God call this woman? Or what does Adam call this woman? Now, if you read English translations, I've only found two words. They call Eve a helper or a helpmeet. I'm here to tell you that's a terrible translation. The Hebrew word is azer, and it means military ally. God told Adam, this is your military ally. Now you can imagine the response of both Adam and Eve. Military ally? Who said we're going to fight? And God says, you'll find out very soon. And he invites Satan to come into the garden. Notice in Genesis 3 how quickly Satan gets in the garden after God tells Adam, this is your military ally. So I tell couples now, this is a day when marriage is under assault like never before. It's so easy to get a divorce. You can get a divorce for any reason. And there will be stresses in your marriage. And you're going to be defeated unless the two of you recognize that your military allies bonded together for battle. And this is the battle that you have to face. And if you remain committed to the battle, then nothing's going to break your marriage. But Satan's going to do everything he can to get your eyes off the battle. He does not want to be defeated. And he recognizes the best way to stop that is to blast marriage. Satan's on a mission to destroy marriage. And he's doing a pretty good job of it. But the reason why he's succeeding, so many of us in the church have lost sight of the battle. God put us here to be a defeater of the evil one and his minions. And by the way, it's not just Adam and Eve. Adam and Eve are no match for Satan and the demons. So what I tell a couple, for your marriage to work, there's got to be three partners. You and the Holy Spirit.
because you're not going to be able to take on this enemy if you try to take it on your own strength. And you're not going to be able to do it, man, husband, if you don't bring in the resources your wife has. And likewise, wife, you can't do it without your husband. And as I say to the church, it can't be done by the men. It can't be done by the women. They've got to work together. But they all have to be focused on the battle. Sorry again for the diversion. But I say this because I think homosexuality and lesbianism is going to be the emerging challenge to evangelical Christianity. I think it's already upon us, and it's going to be a tide that will sweep over us within the next 3 years. We need to be ready.
You, it's time for the drawing. You want to pick a card out of there?
All right. Got the cards here. Let's see if I can still remember how to do this. I haven't shuffled the deck in quite a while. I'm supposed to cut it too, right? All right. Okay, here we go.
Barbara Morgan. There you go. Come on up and you get first pick.
Well, let me tell you what you get to pick from. First, you can take this DVD of that debate I did in front of 700 atheists at Caltech. Or you can get this book, Why the Universe is the Way It Is. It talks about the physics of the universe and why that physics is crucial to bring about the end of all evil. And this is my latest book, literally just published a couple of weeks ago, Navigating Genesis, which gets you through. All right.
Congratulations, Barbara. Okay. One more. I'll pick one this... Well, go ahead.
All right. I'm going to need your help on this one, too. The lighting's... Yeah, you got to get underneath that light.
Oh, this guy cheated. He gets picked every time. I'm kidding. Dan Cuevas. Where are you, Dan? You always wind up with something for free. Where is Dan? He's outside. Well, all right.
Well, if you snooze, you lose, right?
Let's try another one.
All right.
All right. Mike Gallagher. Oh, there we go. Congratulations, Mike. And the third one. Randy Doak. Yay. Well, congratulations. Do we have another question? I've got two more written.
We also need to talk about our book table, though. So
okay. What do you want
to
say?
We gave away a few free ones, but obviously everything, including a lot more, is available at our book table. So thank you to Kalina and Karen over there, and obviously, so visit the book table afterwards. We do have more people lined up here for questions, though, yes.
Okay. Well, let's do one of those, and then I'll do a written one.
Hello. I've heard you say that Adam and Eve were created during the last ice age, at the end of the last ice, about 50,000 years ago, and that they didn't wear clothes until they disobeyed God. Weren't they cold? And explain that's all.
Well, that's a good question. That's one we address in detail in Navigating Genesis. And the reason why we think they were created while the ice age was still in full swing is that we're told in Genesis 2 that the Garden of Eden is where four rivers come together. And two of those rivers flow today, the Tigris and the Euphrates, but the Gihon and the Pishon are dry riverbeds. Now, in order for them to be flowing, they would have had to have been fed by the snow and ice melt of the last ice age. And so that tells us that we have to push the date of God creating Adam and Eve back somewhere between 30,000 to 90,000 years ago. That would put you right in the ice age. And all four rivers would be flowing. Now, you say, well, they're created in the last ice age. Wouldn't they be cold? Well, they would be if they were running around Canada or Siberia, but I think they're a fair amount south, and those four rivers come together in only one location, a location that's now in the southeastern portion of the Persian Gulf. And during the last ice age, the Persian Gulf was almost entirely dry land. We call it the Persian Gulf Oasis. And that's also is an indication that the date for Adam and Eve has to be earlier. It's got to be early enough where most of the Persian Gulf is dry. And the rising of the sea level from the melting ice filled up the Persian Gulf. And that also is consistent with what you see in Genesis 2, because it tells us the Garden of Eden was watered with springs that came up from the deep. Well, underneath the Persian Gulf Oasis is this huge underground water aquifer, which does not exist anywhere near the same extent in the Mesopotamian Valley. Now, if you've got Adam and Eve living in the southeastern portion of the Persian Gulf, and keep in mind you've got a lower sea level, so you've got more air pressure. And by the way, the lower you are, the hotter it is. If you don't believe me, go to the Salton Sea. You get a couple hundred feet below sea level, it gets a lot warmer than it does at sea level. And if you're, say, 500 feet below sea level, it gets really warm. Hey, if you really want to check it out, visit the Dead Sea where you're 1,300 feet below sea level. It's really, really warm there. And the Persian Gulf is a lot farther south than Mesopotamia, and therefore would have been quite tropical and humid in the Garden of Eden. And being tropical and humid, they would be quite comfortable not wearing any clothes, even though 1,000 to 1,500 miles north of where they are, you've got ice from the Ice Age. So, you're next.
Okay, this, I'm very curious about this Apophis. Is that biblical? That's supposed to be striking the earth potentially. Is that from a scientific perspective? Could you talk about that?
I didn't get the name.
Apophis. That's the asteroid that's supposed to be bypassing Earth in 2027, and then possibly striking Earth 2036, around there.
Yes, that's one of several what we call near-Earth asteroids, and it does have a small possibility of striking the Earth, and if it does, it will do considerable damage. It won't wipe out human civilization, but if it were to hit in Manhattan, it would wipe out all of New York City. So that would not be pleasant, at least for those living in New York or anywhere else where that thing might hit. But the probability is a possibility. It's not probable. And exactly how probable it is something that NASA is refusing to say. They're basically, it's a funding ploy. They're now watching 10,000 near-Earth asteroids so they can calculate these probabilities of us being hit. And they say if we get additional funding, we can actually determine what that probability is more than just guesswork. And we might even be able to tell you where it's going to hit. And if the probability is, say, more than 50%, then we could actually have NASA send a rocket ship up there and push the asteroid away. If it's a big asteroid, that's not an easy thing to do. You might want to blow it up, but maybe that wouldn't be a good idea either, because now you've got a bunch of pieces striking the Earth instead of just one piece. And especially if you blow it up with something radioactive, that might not be a good idea either. So, but that's really what's behind NASA's search. But they really are watching 10,000 asteroids, and they'd like to watch 100,000 asteroids. But what they've named are a few. There's about three or four that they've named where the probability is greater than 1% that they could strike the Earth sometime in the next 1,000 years. By the way, a lot of astronomers think that that's an underestimate. Just based on the number of craters we have here on the Earth, it looks like the probability could be a little bit higher. I mean, if you take care to drive a little bit east of Phoenix and go a little bit south of the town of Winslow, you can visit a meteorite crater. And I'm sad to say this. Last time I visited it was free. You could just drive right up to the edge of the crater and look down and take photos. Now they decided to charge money. I don't know how much it costs. I think it's like $20 to see it now. But you can go online and see photos of it. The thing is nearly a mile in diameter, and 350 feet deep. And that was caused by a rock no bigger than 100 feet across. So NASA would like to watch rocks that small. And that's their goal, because even a rock that small, if it hits in the wrong place, could do a lot of damage. You say, how much damage did it cause? Well, more damage. More energy was released by that strike in Winslow, Arizona, than was released in Hiroshima, atomic bomb explosion. And the probability of that happening, you're going to get one event like that at least every 10,000 years. So, and what NASA's pointed out is we take insurance policies out against risks that are smaller than the risk of us being hurt by an asteroid or a comet. So I think NASA's got a worthwhile point. Well, we should be watching these things. And by the way, there's a secondary payoff. If we watch the asteroids, the same project can also watch dead satellites. And there's thousands of dead satellites up there. And when they return to the Earth, they will do some damage as well.
Gloria, before you ask, I've got one. I'm trying to put this together from your notes here. Regarding your book, Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men, can you comment on the phenomenon of legitimate demonic entities? Is that close to what you're asking?
Yeah, I think we have that book over there, Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men. It's a book we wrote on the UFO phenomena. And, you know, I've been studying UFOs since I was 16, not by intention. What happened when I was 16 is I was the leader of the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada for Vancouver, and we set up a booth at the Pacific National Exhibition. Well, they put the Flying Saucer Club right next to our booth. So I had to quickly become a flying saucer expert, and everywhere I went, I was, quote, the flying saucer expert. So that was my job both at the University of British Columbia, University of Toronto, and at Caltech. So anyway, wound up writing this book, making the point that the vast majority of what people report as UFOs are really not UFOs as we think they would be. In my experience, about 99% of what people report as UFOs are natural phenomena, military exercises, or hoaxes. And when I was at the University of British Columbia, the hoax thing was way up there, because we had these undergraduate societies that just loved getting their name in the newspaper with different flying saucer events. But there's a 1% residual where you cannot explain it as a hoax or something the military is doing or a natural phenomena. And that 1% residual, what's interesting is that the closer you get to the encounter, the more harmful it becomes. It was the physicist Alan Hynek that coined the phrase encounters, close encounters. And he defined a close encounter, the first kind, as where the sighting is within 500 feet of the observer. A close encounter, the second kind, is where there's some kind of physical evidence, either a crash site or you actually see, close enough encounter where you actually get harmed by the event. And a close encounter, the third kind, is where the human actually has a conversation with a being that's part of the UFO. And but close encounters of the first and second kind, he pointed out, always have consequences. People of close encounters of the first kind, the least they're going to get away with is recurring terrifying nightmares. And people of close encounters of the second kind, they're the ones that are going to actually have physical harm done to them, you know, some kind of injury. And in some cases, it's even been death. And then close encounters of the third kind is where their psychology begins to be impacted and they begin to have these messages and commands sent to them. And these are where we get the abduction stories, where people claim that they've been abducted, and it's amazing how many of them claim that they were sexually raped by one of these UFO beings. Now, what we write in the book is the encounter is never beneficial. It's always harmful. And it only happens to people who have significant open doors to occult activity. So what I do in the book is give you a list of 41 different ways that you can be practicing the occult, and make the point that typically people who have these close encounters will have at least 6 of those 41 items going on in their life. And I basically close the book off by saying, I'm a scientist, this is testable. Close the doors, and that'll be the end of your UFO experiences. I've never seen that violated. Whenever an individual closes all the doors to occult activity, that puts an end to their UFO encounters. I've also seen the opposite. The more people practice the occult, the higher the probability they'll have a UFO encounter. And if they're really into the occult, they'll have repeated UFO encounters. Now, what's interesting, too, is where the encounters take place. By far, the highest percentage occur at 3 a.m. in the morning, plus or minus 30 minutes, on lonely country roads. What's interesting is they almost never happen in a place that's totally wild. It's usually some place where there's a lonely country road or a single cabin. So it's rare for it to happen in a city, and it's rare for it to happen in a total wilderness setting. But where do, who hangs out at lonely country roads at 3 a.m. in the morning? Astronomers do. So you would expect that astronomers would have the highest percentage of UFO encounters, because that's their job, is to drive out on a lonely country road to a telescope and spend all night looking at the nighttime sky. I've done literally thousands of hours of that. Never had a UFO encounter. And what I write about in the book is, astronomers have one of the lowest incidences of UFO encounters. But that's because they have one of the lowest incidences of occult behavior, occult activity. And I do tell a story of two astronomers at York University who every time they came in the telescope saw a UFO. And these were two astronomers that only logged 3 or 4 hours of observing time a year. And I was logging 1,500 hours, never saw a thing. I had other people I knew, astronomers, were logging 1,000 hours plus. They never saw a thing. But these two always had encounters, but they were deep into the occult. And so that explains why they had the encounters that they had. So the bottom line is, close the doors, and that will get rid of your UFO experiences.
I had a question. Years ago, we had a friend named Ashley who was going through a rough time, and I was trying to encourage him, and I gave him the scripture of where Jesus says that 2 sparrows are sold for 1 farthing, which seemed like a penny or something like that to me, and that Jesus told the person, you are worth more than many sparrows, and not one sparrow falls to the ground without the Father. And then I thought that that would be something comforting. And the person came back and said, that is saying that God has the knowledge that the bird is falling. That does not mean that that God cares that the bird is falling or would want to do anything to stop the bird from falling. Well, I kind of, had always pictured like God seeing the bird fall and he's in control of the wind. God is in control of the wind, kind of putting a little bit burst of wind to help break the bird's fall. I don't know, maybe I'm, trying too much. But is that really only just God has knowledge? Is that all that verse is trying to say?
All right, well, if you look around that passage, it's really making a point that God cares for all of his creatures. He says, look at the sparrow. Look at all the food I provide. I mean, if you look at the birds, they have an easy time of life. They just flit around and they pick up food here and there. I mean, one sense, you can be envious of them. I mean, their jobs are a lot less challenging than ours. And there just seems to be food everywhere for them. He says, look, I provide for all these creatures. And I provide an abundance. And, if you look at the vegetation, which is basically the source of all of our food. I mean, God says to Adam in Genesis 1, take care of the green plants. That's the base of the food chain. If you don't take care of the green plants, nobody gets to eat. But look at how these green plants overproduce. I mean, if God wasn't there, if it was just Darwinian mechanisms, the trees and the grasses, they would simply produce enough grain, enough fruit, so that they could be able to reproduce efficiently. I mean, how much fruit and seeds does all these plants need to produce? Not that much if all they're trying to do is preserve their species. But they overproduce by hundreds of times.